Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
This is Eat, Sleep, Work, Repeat, a podcast about making work better. Hello, how you doing? This is Bruce Daisley. First, a shout out. If you're interested in work or how it's evolving, how we can make more of it, then I'd strongly recommend you sign up for the newsletter of this podcast. You can find it by going to eatsleepworkrepeat.com. There's a link at the very top. There's also a link in the show notes here on your podcast app. So if you click that and sign up, and just to give you a sort of sense of what that's like, last week's newsletter, alongside a whole load of articles that you might have missed about work, remote work, motivation, all that stuff, there was a piece about computer games. And I found myself sort of about a week ago reading something that's sort of become the Bible of the computer games design industry. So if you think about computer games, people play computer games for hours on end for no extrinsic reward, right? You're not paid to play computer games. And other than what the game intrinsically offers them, there's nothing in it for people. It just means that the people who design computer games need to really understand human motivation to a really sophisticated level. And this book that I was reading is by a veteran games designer called Rafe Costa. It's become a classic. And I think the reason it's become so esteemed, it's been like in print for 15 years now, is because it's a really intriguing read that I think asks, for me, fascinating questions about humans and just what makes humans tick. So in the newsletter, I go through what I think is relevant for it. But I think the critical thing that I find is that if you swap the word games for the word work in his text, you almost lose zero meaning. So Costa talks about the importance of, above all, of learning. One quote he says, games that fail to exercise the brain become boring. Practice can keep a game fresh for a while. In many cases, we'll soon get bored and move on. And that for me seems really relevant to how we're now in a rhythm of very repetitive video calls. In games, they have this obsession with trying to make games fun. And I know at work, we flinch from trying to make work fun. Where fun doesn't necessarily mean in games putting a smile on your face so much as giving you a meaningful challenge that is rewarding to fulfill. And it's interesting to me, I suspect a lot of bosses probably describe their own job as fun. But when it comes to describing their team's jobs, they aren't prepared to make them fun. And Costa makes one other point that I think is vital for understanding motivation. He says, in games, boredom is the opposite of learning. And with games, learning is the drug. That is really fascinating for me. I remember one big firm I worked where talented people, like the most talented people you could ever imagine, joined, eager to change the world and really, they quickly learned that the promotion system there only allowed them to progress one level every 2 years. A lot of companies have these level systems. And so this sort of dead-eyed acceptance dawned on people that their enthusiasm counted for nothing. It gradually sort of turned them into these vampiric waifs, performatively trying to do their job, but saddened that their own potential was atrophying away. And, you know, that really struck me. If learning is the drug, these were patients that were deprived of it. Anyway, really intriguing. If you are interested in these things, the newsletter sort of goes into great depth what we can learn from computer games design. The book's called A Theory of Fun. I think there's a whole load we can learn that would help all of us make our jobs, our team jobs, a lot more rewarding. And if you do sign up for the newsletter, a whole load of people reply to me each week with comments, opinions. It's, you know, it's a great place to sort of join into a bit of a discussion. Right, today's episode is for anyone who is just curious about things, really. Work ultimately is a practice of the brain and how our brain processes and reacts to things. And today's episode is an exploration, a fascinating exploration of neuroscience. So I've got a friend who's studying neuroscience. And a couple of years ago, one of those chats, we were at a wedding somewhere, and I was chatting to him. And I said, who should I be reading in neuroscience? And he said the best voice in the field was a psychologist called Lisa Feldman Barrett. Sure enough, I looked her up, and her book, How Emotions Are Made, is dazzling and brilliant. It covers themes of understanding emotions. One of the things that Lisa believes is that we don't arrive programmed on Earth with emotions. We learn them along the way. And that means different cultures have different, slightly different takes on emotion. The more emotions we're taught to understand, the more we can feel. So, for example, in her book, she says, people who read fiction and learn to appreciate the nuance of different emotions, different feelings, end up being able to achieve and reach a wider range of emotions. She's got a new book out now. How Emotions Are Made was the first book, several hundred pages long. Her new book, 7.5 Lessons About the Brain, is much shorter and much, much more accessible. If you're looking for a simple explainer about the brain, it's a really handy summary. I have to disclose, I way preferred the first book. It's a brilliant discussion. Along the way, you're going to discover that no, your dog isn't capable of feeling guilt. We talk about the test that was in a previous episode way, way, way ago about collective intelligence. And the test is called the Reading the Mind in the Eyes test. So this was a test that was created by someone called Simon Baron Cohen. Yeah, I think he's his cousin. And this test was created to measure autism, but it's actually been used since to measure people's ability to read and empathize emotions. So we talk about that test. If you search Reading the Mind in the Eyes test, that test will come up and you can have a go, you can play around with it. We talk about the death penalty, actually, because one of the things that Lisa says is in the US, juries are asked before they give the death penalty to see if the person responsible felt remorse. And she said, we're incapable of judging if someone else is feeling remorse. Really fascinating. We end up talking about Elon Musk and brain-computer interfaces as well. There's a whole load of stuff in this one. Here's my discussion with Lisa Feldman Barrett. Lisa, thank you so much for joining me. I'm really thrilled because I've been a fan of both your previous book, How Emotions Are Made, and your new book that we'll come on and talk about. Thank you for sort of taking the time to chat to us. In the outset, I'm sort of really intrigued because a lot of the time I read your stuff, it challenges what I believe that I knew. So I thought I knew about how the brain worked. We've got this lizard brain that sort of controls our urges. Then we develop this sort of mammalian, this emotional brain, our limbic brain that came next. And then we've got this sort of human brain that controls our logic in the sort of neocortex. I thought I understood all of that. And then you tell me that actually all of that is to some extent a bit of an illusion. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. And in fact, the really funny thing about it is that scientists have known since the 1970s, since they've been able to really peer deep into the molecular structure of cells, that this idea of a layered brain, which in science is called the triune brain, scientists have known since the 1970s that this is false. That's right around the time when the triune brain became very, very popular in a book by Carl Sagan called The Dragons of Eden, with which won a Pulitzer Prize.
So how do we know that's not the case? Why? Because we can use fMRI machines. We can use brains.
No. The evidence that brains did not evolve in layers, the evidence that the only animal that has a lizard brain really is a lizard, the evidence that really all mammalian brains have the same basic plan. In fact, probably all vertebrate brains have the same basic building plan, the same construction plan, really comes from the study of molecular genetics, peering deep into very, very, very microscopic aspects of the genes in cells. And so using these molecular tracing tools, it's possible to discover that really all brains, as I said, all brains that have ever been studied, which are primarily mammalian brains, so mammals, so, you know, cats and dogs and monkeys and so on, but also the molecular markers are there in other vertebrates like fish and birds and so on, that really all brains have the same kinds of neurons. These brains that we're talking about have the same kinds of neurons. They're just arranged slightly differently based on how long the time period of each developmental segment goes. If your brain develops for a little longer in one part of development, you end up getting a bigger structure. So as brains get bigger, they reorganize their cells. But basically, you have all the same neurons as a blood-sucking lamprey. There are really no differences. And so you don't have an inner lizard. You don't have a limbic system. You don't have some kind of inner beast that your very rational side is attempting to control. This idea that the brain is a battleground between rationality and emotion for control of your behavior goes all the way back to Plato. And it's a morality tale. It's a tale of how we understand how we're responsible for our own behavior, but it has no basis in biology at all.
Well, I'm intrigued then there, because I'm sure there's something that you said in how emotions are made. You talked about how sometimes we project emotions onto animals and that animals really aren't capable of experiencing emotions. But if our brains are the same as animals to some extent, then surely animals would be able to experience these different changes in affect or these different emotions, no?
Well, I think that you're pointing to something important, but you're also confusing two things that many people confuse. And so I'll just take a minute to try to explain. Why do we have a brain? What is a brain's most important job? A brain's most important job is not to think or see or feel. Your brain's most important job is to control your body, to run a budget for your body. Body budgeting, the scientific term, is called allostasis. The idea is that your brain is not budgeting money, it's budgeting internal resources like water and salt and glucose and hormones to keep you alive and well so that you can, from biology standpoint, do your most important job, which is to propagate your genes to the next generation. Mm. So this continuous budgeting process is largely invisible to you. It continues day and night, from the moment that you're born until the moment that you die inside your own body, and you're not wired to perceive it. So right now, it probably seems to you like you're just sitting calmly and listening to me talk, but you and every one of your listeners right now, and me included, have a drama of intense magnitudes unfolding inside your body that you're largely unaware of. That ongoing drama is continually sending sense data to your brain about the changes in your body. This is true for all brains. Okay, so all brains do body budgeting for an animal's body, and the body sends sense data back to the brain about what's going on inside the body. If you were wired to perceive these sensations, you would never pay attention to anything outside your own skin ever again. And if you doubt me, just think about the last time you had GI distress and how it completely narrows your world to a very small, or the last time you had flu or something, you know, you're really not tracking your body to the same degree as, say, vision, which is has a lot of detail and a lot of sharpness. And so evolution has given you kind of a workaround that hints when your body budget is generally in balance and when it's in the red. And that is what you might call feeling or mood. A scientist calls affect. These are physical feelings of comfort, discomfort, feeling calm, feeling agitated. Mood or feeling is with you every moment of your life, whether you're emotional or not, and whether you're aware of it or not. And all brains, invertebrates, as far as we know, are wired for mood or for feeling of this sort, for affect, because it's a consequence of running a body budget. But what scientists call affect or mood or feeling is not emotion.
Right.
They're really properties for humans. Affect is a property of consciousness. I'm not saying that animals are all necessarily aware of their feelings, although I think many of them are. Many of them have feelings of affect, feeling pleasure, pain, comfort, discomfort. But the point is that humans have the capacity to create emotion out of these feelings, not all the time, but a lot of times. Emotion is more complex than feeling. It's a way that a human brain explains or makes sense of sensory changes in the body in relation to what's going on around you in the world.
So a dog can feel content, but we shouldn't project onto the dog that the dog's in a fond state of happiness. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yes. And it really, what it really comes down to is there's a lot to unpack in that statement that we haven't talked about that's in the book. But the general idea is that your brain is constructing concepts to make sense of knowledge, to make sense of the sensations from your body as they occur in a particular situation. And a dog's brain also can make concepts. The question is, can a dog's brain make the kind of concepts that a human brain can make? And the answer is probably not. Humans, because by virtue of how our brains are wired, probably have the capacity to make many, many more kinds of concepts and concepts that have some degree of abstraction. Emotion concepts are these kinds of concepts. So a dog will feel pleasantness, unpleasantness. Your dog might be attached to you. Your dog might be agitated or calm. But it's very unlikely from your dog's perspective that your dog feels guilt or shame or anger or fear. Although you perceive your dog that way, because your brain has the capacity to make those concepts.
So when we see our dog has eaten some food that it's not meant to, and it's looking, as we might describe it to others, look how ashamed she is. In fact, this is us projecting that.
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's projecting. I would say, well, first of all, there's evidence to show that dogs themselves, their own brains don't construct instances of guilt. When we look at a dog's movements in relation to the context, we make an inference about what the dog's state is. And that inference that we make is just the same as the kind of inference that we make about each other. We don't read each other's emotions either. We look at other people, we listen to them, we look at their movements, their facial movements, their body movements, we listen to how their voice sounds, to what they say, and so on. And we make an inference based on what we know. We make an inference about what emotional state that person is in. We do this with each other all the time. We do it with our pets. We do it with our plants. We do it with our cars. Humans have the capacity to make inferences about mental life and impose them on many, many, many things, including other humans and dogs.
So one of the ways that you got into this was that you found yourself looking at, I guess earlier in your academic career, you're looking at to try and understand the universality of emotions across different cultures and understanding that we would imagine superficially that every culture smiles, every culture blushes, every culture reacts in the same way when they're angry. You discovered that idea that these are universal, hardwired response to things is an illusion. In fact, there's no such thing as hardwiring when it comes to the brain with a lot of the things that we do. Is that right?
Yeah. So, I mean, the word hardwired is really tricky when it comes to the brain because, of course, your brain is made up of cells, some of which are called neurons. And these neurons do have a long wire attached to them called an axon. But neurons, as my engineering colleagues like to remind me, neurons are not soldered together. When a neuron fires, a pulse, an electrical pulse, propagates down the axon to the end where there's a cleft, a space, and it releases chemicals. And then the other neurons pick up those chemicals and then they fire and so on and so forth. So the way to think about it is that your brain doesn't really have hard wiring. What it has is the capacity to reinstate or re-implement patterns of activity with the wiring and the chemicals that it uses. So your neurons, which have wires, are embedded in a chemical bath, basically. And those chemicals change the ease with which neurons speak to each other. And so what your brain is doing is conjuring trillions of patterns. And these patterns, every time you have a memory, for example, your brain doesn't store memory. It doesn't retrieve a memory. It remakes a memory. When you remember something, your brain is re-implementing a pattern. It's reinstating it. So first of all, your brain isn't really hard. Nothing is really hardwired. Second of all, much of the wiring that is there is very influenced by development. You know, an infant brain is not a miniature adult brain. It's a brain that is waiting for a set of wiring instructions from the world. And so a lot of the things that we think of as hardwired are patterns that the brain makes easily because it's been making them for decades over and over and over again. Little brains wire themselves to their world, their physical world, and they're also their social world, the world that we create for them. Part of what they learn is they learn the emotion concepts for their culture and how to make meaning of their physical states in a way that makes sense in their culture. And so before we even get to cultural differences, I think it's important to realize that people perceive emotion in each other with great confidence, which leads us to believe that, you know, we're reading emotion in other people's faces or in their voices or so on. But body movements and facial movements are not a language to be read like words on a page. No one has body language. People make bodily movements, facial movements, and other people perceive, they make inferences, they guess at the emotional meaning of those movements. And so when you're angry, the data show in Western cultures, people scowl about 30% of the time. That's more than chance. It's more than what would happen randomly. But that means 70% of the time when people are angry, and this is within our own culture, they don't scowl. They do other things with their face. They might smile, they might laugh, they might cry. They might have a stone, you know, like a stone still face. Yeah. And people also scowl when they're not angry. They scowl when they're confused. They scowl when they're concentrating really hard. They scowl to signal that someone told a really bad joke. From a scientific standpoint, we would say scowling is one expression of emotion, but it is not the expression of emotion. It's a stereotype, a Western stereotype of the expression of anger. Because most of the time, people are not scowling when they're angry. They're doing something else. When's the last time you saw someone win an Academy Award for scowling when they're angry? It's just not something that people do very often. And we think of it actually as sort of cartoonish. And that's because it is. It's a stereotype. Even before we talk about other cultures, we can say in our own culture, variation is the norm when it comes to expressing emotion. You don't always smile when you're happy, and you often smile when you're not happy. You don't always frown when you're sad, and you often frown when you're not sad, and so on. So human brains are pretty good at making guesses about what smiles and scowls and frowns mean, emotionally speaking, in context. And the guesses are very different in other cultures.
I guess that brings us on to one of the big things that I've learned from both of your books, which is effectively your brain spends most of its time predicting what's going to happen. It's running simulations, predicting different circumstances, and it's just trying to sort of second guess what decisions it will make based on what happens. Have I expressed that correctly? I was really taken with this idea that the brain is constantly running simulations. Why would it do that?
First of all, everything we know about how brains work, from, you know, the anatomy of how they're set up to the way neurons process signals, you know, all the different types of scientific evidence really point to the idea that brains are predicting, they're not reacting to the world. So to you and to me and to everyone else, it feels as if we're reacting to things that happen. But actually, our brains are constantly predicting. If we were able to stop the world right now, your brain would be taking stock of what just happened in your body and what just happened in the world. And it would be making a prediction about what's going to happen next. And then those predictions are not some kind of abstract thing. They're actually the brain changing the pattern of firing of its own neurons before the sense data arrive. And then when the sense data arrives, the brain can check its guess, check its prediction to see whether it was correct or not. And if it's correct, then your actions just proceed very automatically. And the reason for doing this is that it's metabolically efficient. It's in a big brain like ours, and in fact in all brains, but particularly in big brains like ours, it's very metabolically efficient to predict and correct rather than to react. And in fact, there are non-neurotypical brains in people who are struggling with autism, for example, look more like reactive brains. Brains that are neurotypical are predictive. And to give you an example of what I mean by simulation, and a really easy thing for your listeners to do would be to keep their eyes open, look at something in the world, keep your eyes open, and in your mind's eye, imagine a red apple of the kind that you would eat, or like a red apple that you would eat. Can you, in your mind's eye, imagine a red apple? Can you see it, you know, kind of like a fuzzy, like in a fuzzy way?
Yeah.
Yeah. And can you imagine what it feels like to hold that apple in your hand?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe to what it would sound like, the crunch that you would hear if you took a bite of that apple, and what the taste would be like. If you can do any of these things, hear the crunch, taste the sweet tartness, and so on, see the apple, then you can have these experiences because your brain is actually changing the firing of its own visual neurons, its own auditory neurons, the neurons that are important for seeing and hearing and tasting and so on. Your brain's changing the firing of its own neurons in the absence of an apple, just by me saying the word apple. Mm. And those are essentially predictions. And so if I were in front of you and I actually pulled out an apple, then your brain would compare the sense data from the apple to its conjurings and off you would go.
It's interesting what you say there about, I forget the word you use, but atypical or untypical brains, and they don't work in the same way. So I was thinking that I guess some of the challenges that when people have mental health issues, they probably predict, they make predictions about what other people's actions are going to be that are inaccurate, maybe informed by a sort of different perspective in their head. But you said that also extends to people who are on the autistic spectrum.
Right. So autism is considered to be a disorder of prediction. People who are on the spectrum and who struggle, their brains actually aren't wired in a way that makes prediction very easy. And as a consequence, they are often what we call experientially blind, meaning that their brains have a hard time guessing what particular actions mean, what particular sensations mean. Most disorders have a problem with prediction. So for example, depression is, you can think of, there are many ways, many paths to develop depression, but you can think about depression as basically like a locked in brain, a brain that is using its own internal model. It's making its own predictions based on past experience. It's not correcting those predictions with reference to the world. Let's say, to use our apple example, let's say I pulled out an apple and it was a Granny Smith apple, not red, and the bite, the taste would be maybe a little more tart. There's sense data there that doesn't match your prediction. And when the sense data doesn't match your prediction, doesn't match your guess, your brain has a couple of choices. One thing it can do is it can correct your prediction. It can take in the information that you didn't predict and learn it so that you can predict better next time. So that's what we call taking in prediction error. We call it learning. That's what learning is, basically. Another possibility is your brain can say, metaphorically, I don't care about the prediction error. It turns out learning prediction error is expensive, metabolically speaking. So sometimes your brain won't learn it. It will just go with its prediction. Like, for example, if you're making apple pie, it doesn't really matter whether you're using, well, a baker would tell you it matters that you're, whether you're using, Granny Smith or Cortland apples. But really, you just want an apple that has some degree of substance to it that's not going to turn to mush. And so it might not be important to learn the difference. So your brain's always making estimates about whether it needs to learn something or not, or whether it can treat the sense data as that it didn't predict as noise, or whether it has to learn it. You can think about depression as kind of a body budget that is running a major deficit. And so what do you do in your actual budget when you're running a deficit? You stop spending, right? You slow your spending. What are the two most expensive things a brain can do? It can learn and it can move your body. So if it's going to stop spending or really reduce its spending, what's it going to do? It's going to make, you're going to feel fatigue. So you're not going to move as much and you're not going to learn as much. You're going to be kind of locked into your own beliefs, your own internal model, and you're not going to be updating or learning as much and coordinating to the environment that you're in. Anxiety is an increase in arousal that comes from not predicting well, being experientially blind, being unable to predict or unable to make sense of sense data, or having difficulty figuring out which prediction to go with. Even physical illnesses like chronic pain and diabetes and heart disease and so on can be understood in terms of problems of a predicting brain.
Tell me this, if there's no such thing as absolute universal emotions in others, are you worried that some of this science is appropriated? I mean, I'm just thinking of a couple of examples. Firstly, I used someone's recruitment tool last year. They were sort of demonstrating it to me. And one of the stages in it was, it borrowed from the Simon Baron Cohen reading the mind in the eyes experiment, which I'm sure you know, which is, it gives you 40 photographs from, I think, a Vanity Fair in the 1980s, and it asks you to say what the emotions that the people in them were feeling. And that test, you'll know, is used to diagnose autism. But this recruitment tool had taken some of the work that I think researchers like Anita Williams-Woolley have done, saying that that is a good predictor of someone's collective intelligence. I guess there's a few steps along the way there. It's saying, as part of the recruitment tool, can you read people's emotions? And if you can, you would be a better candidate. But what you're saying to me, to some extent, and what you've said, I think in one of the TED Talks I saw, where you said, you know, when we look at a defendant in the dock in a court case, we cannot tell whether they are feeling remorseful or not. We are incapable of reading emotion in that objective way. Are you worried then, firstly, that some of this science doesn't seem consistent with your learning? And secondly, that it could be misappropriated in these ways?
Well, yes. Let me first say the mind in the eyes task is when anyone uses that to make predictions about someone's actions in real life, they are making a very big mistake. And this is a mistake that has been known for about 30 years, although for some reason people keep ignoring it. And that's the following. In the mind in the eyes task, or really any task on emotion that the majority of the emotion recognition tasks, as they're called, that have been published in the last 30 years, 40 years, they have a particular method they use. So here's the method. You show someone a set of eyes, or you show them a face, and you give them a set of words, and you ask them to pick the word that matches the face. So I might show you, let's say, a scowling face and give you six words, and you know, your task is to pick the word that matches the face, so you'd pick anger. In the mind in the eyes task, it's very similar, except I think you're given four words. And people do a pretty good job on average. Neurotypical brains do a pretty good job. The thing is, though, if I remove those words and I just give you the eyes and I say, how does this person feel? Everybody's performance tanks. And actually, we've published evidence on this using the mind in the eyes task, actually, in addition to lots of evidence that's been published on emotion perception tasks. In real life, people don't make a face, pose it in a very stereotypic way, and then you give them a set of six words and they have to pick the word that matches the face. No, in everyday life, faces are continually moving. Eyes are continually moving. Your gaze shifts, you show more sclera, yeah. You show less sclera, more white, less white, what have you. And what the brain is doing, what your brain is doing, what my brain is doing, what everybody's brain is doing, is making a guess based on what they know and what is going on in the current situation. They're making a guess. Some people guess better. Some people guess worse. You're guessing what the person is going to do next based on what you know. And some people guess better, some people guess worse, but that guessing is not well predicted by those tests, because those tests artificially narrow the options down to 4 or 6 choices, which is not what happens in real life. And so there is a major problem here. And the major problem is that the findings don't predict well in real life. And moreover, I would say, the experiments that are run usually are using highly stereotyped expressions. These are expressions that we believe are the expressions of these emotions, but actually in real life, variation is the norm. So it's not the case that facial movements are meaningless. Facial movements aren't random. Eye movements aren't random. They're meaningful. You just have to figure out what they mean. And your brain is doing a very complicated calculus to do this. But I think, you know, you brought up remorse, and I think remorse is a really good example. In a courtroom in the United States, I'm not sure how it is in the UK, but in the United, well, actually, you don't have capital punishment in the UK, right?
No, we don't.
In the United States, yeah, well, we could talk about how civilized that is relative to the US. But anyways, in the US, I just took off my scientific lab coat there for a minute and let my own personal feelings show. So sorry about that. But in the US, there is capital punishment. And the research shows that the difference for a jury in the jury decides what the sentence will be. And in capital cases, as they're called, the distinction between giving someone life in prison versus giving them the death penalty really rests on whether or not the jury believes the defendant to be remorseful. And what they're using, typically juries, they have an expectation of a typical American expression of remorse on the assumption that this is universal, right? So they're expecting to see, you know, maybe tears and a gut-wrenching kind of apology. And this is the sort of stereotype of an American display of remorse. But the fact is that someone can express remorse in many different ways. And there are other cultural stereotypes for other cultural norms for expressing remorse. And if you happen to be from one of those cultures, then it's possible that the jury might not perceive remorse in you, and you may end up getting the death penalty being awarded to you. And that actually has happened in a number of cases. And it's a problem because in the United States, in order to get a fair trial, according to the Supreme Court, the jurors have to be able to know the heart and mind of the defendant. And the fact is, no human can know the mind and heart of any other human. All we're doing is guessing. And sometimes we guess well, and sometimes we don't. And so it's better to be humble about our guessing, particularly when someone's life depends on the outcome.
Yeah, absolutely. That's intriguing for me. I think in your first book, you give a lot of photographs of sports stars, and you know, and it's actually incredibly difficult to read whether they're angry or in a state of delight. And these things that we consider to be almost very obvious are actually never as obvious as we might imagine.
More with my discussion with Lisa Feldman Barrett after this.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Now, more of my discussion with the author of 7.5 Lessons About the Brain, Lisa Feldman Barrett.
Tell me this, as someone who's sort of studied brains and maybe trying to understand the way that these things work, when you hear someone like Elon Musk talking about brain technology interfaces, do you get excited? Do you roll your eyes? Do you believe it's possible? What are your takes on things like that?
I'm not going to comment on exactly what Elon Musk says, but I will say that I do think that brain-machine interfaces are extremely interesting. I work with several engineers who are involved in attempting to build technology that allows people to control machines and so on with their brains. And I think it's very cool technology. It's very cool from a scientific standpoint because we can learn a lot about how brains work based on the kind of effective technology that we can build. The only thing I'll say is that in science, particularly when it comes to human outcomes, it's important to be humble and curious and to not overclaim. So it's very different, right, when a researcher is announcing a discovery versus when a company is announcing a discovery, right? Because companies are trying to make money from their work, and researchers typically don't. I mean, there are obviously some researchers who work for industry, and there are some researchers who patent their work or who try to sell it to industry. But my point is that innovations that are done for research purposes, for the purpose of learning how something works, has different constraints and concerns than research that is done for the purposes of selling people things. When you're trying to sell people things and make a buck, it's very easy to get into the situation of overclaiming what you can do.
Got it.
Which is what, you know, emotion recognition systems do currently, for the most part. Companies are overclaiming what they can do.
Yeah, because I was really struck. I remember reading something a few years ago about a sort of field that someone was trying to make claims about of neuroeconomics. Neuroeconomics, the principle behind neuroeconomics was that you could spot the cells in a brain that were making a decision down to the sort of the neuron level, and you could, across multiple people, you could track these things. And of course, reading your work, it's pretty clear that there's no such thing as a single cell for various things. And certainly there's not a single cell for brain cell for the same thing across different people, that our brains are basically formed uniquely and individually. And so, you know, it strikes me that there's a lot of casual use of these terms to come up with invented areas. And so I was just intrigued whether you believed that technology brain interfaces would have the same impact.
I have to say, as a scientist, I try hard not to be guided by belief, and I try to be guided by data. The data that I report, you know, that I describe in how emotions are made, don't just come from my lab. They come from hundreds of labs across the world. The point is that when you have an experience or your brain is controlling your actions, it's really a whole brain event. And the best that any scientist can do at the moment is, even in a non-human animal, is record, you know, a couple of hundred neurons at a time. You know, a human brain has something like 128 billion neurons if you count all the parts, including the cerebellum, which people often leave out, which is why I'm saying it. Oftentimes you see statistics like, you know, 85 or so billion neurons. But actually, if you count all the parts, it's about 128, give or take, billion neurons. That's a lot of neurons. Nobody can measure individual neurons at that scale. But what we can see by even measuring just tens of hundreds of neurons is that there's much more variation even within a single brain. You don't even have to be talking about across brains. So yes, there's great promise in computer brain interface, great promise for understanding how brains work and to control bodies and maybe also to get certain jobs done. We have to be humble and we have to be curious, particularly when we are asking questions that can influence people's outcomes. If your business is to sell something to someone, you know, let's say you have a emotion recognition business. So you're trying to predict people's emotions by their facial movements. And, you know, you can predict, say, the best evidence that's available would be that you could predict maybe 30% of the time. That's better than chance. And so if your business is to get people to buy stuff, doesn't really matter if you're wrong. But if your business is trying to read emotions for the purposes of deciding who gets education or who gets a job or whether somebody is guilty of a crime or not, you know, or whether somebody is sick and needs treatment or not, these kinds of decisions have tremendous impact on people's outcomes. And frankly, a 30% accuracy rate is unacceptable. Would you want your outcomes or the outcomes of your children being decided by a system that could be wrong 70% of the time?
Yeah, it's terrifying.
Yeah, exactly.
When you look forwards, I guess, last question, what are you most excited about, either in terms of how technology will enable us to understand different things or what you believe discoveries we still need to crack? What are you most excited about?
Well, that's really hard to answer because there are many, many things to be excited about. There are still some really basic things that we don't understand, like how does your brain, you know, as I said before, your brain's evolved to control bodies. They didn't evolve to think or see or feel. You Right. think and feel and see in the service of controlling your body. That's not how it feels to you, but that's what your brain is doing. But the fact is, we don't really understand how your sensory experiences of your body and of the world really help to guide that body budget or control that body budget. If we did, we probably could cure all kinds of illnesses. So that's really exciting to me. And it's really exciting to me to learn, as I have recently, that a lot of the problems that people have both mentally and physically actually stem from metabolic problems, from problems. A lot of the things that we think of as mental difficulties actually stem from a compromised body budget, from problems with metabolism. And so that's really exciting, actually.
Go on. What would that look like?
Well, here's the thing. Some of the body budgeting problems that occur, for example, in depression, also occur in heart disease and in chronic pain and in Alzheimer's disease and in Parkinson's disease. I'm not saying that it's all identical. I'm saying that one thing that is important in all of these diseases is that your body budget is running a deficit. I mean, what's really interesting to me is that if we were going to design a system that really screwed up a human body budget, metabolic budget, it would be the world that we currently live in. You know, we don't get enough sleep. We don't eat healthfully. We don't exercise enough. We're on social media all the time, which is inherently, you know, ambiguous. And social ambiguity is really, really hard, metabolically speaking, for a human nervous system. And so, you know, all of these things are basically making withdrawals, metaphorically speaking, out of your body budget, leaving you with a deficit. And what happens when you run a deficit? Well, you feel like crap, first of all. And so affectively, you feel horrible. And what do you do with that feeling? Usually you make a negative emotion out of it. But also, when you're running a deficit, it's hard for you to learn. It's hard for you to empathize with other people. It's hard for you to be innovative. It's hard for you to take someone else's perspective. The way to think about it is that the metabolic tax that you pay is not a big tax each time. It's a little tax, just a little bit of a tax each time, which adds up over a long period to an illness, to a metabolic illness like depression or, you know, over a longer time, heart disease, or over a really longer time, Alzheimer's disease. I think the really exciting thing about this discovery is that we know how to fix it, in that we understand, once we understand how it works a little better, we will understand how to be architects of our lives in a way that can optimize what we experience and optimize our performance on the job and also at home. So for example, evidence-based management research, this is, by the way, courtesy of my friend Andrew Mawson, who studies what factors contribute to workplace performance. It's all the things that, you know, enhance someone's body budget. So allowing employees and cultivating an environment full of trust and, you know, opportunities to rest and, you know, exercise and actually enhances performance in this really surprising way. And it's because, you know, when you have a balanced body budget, you have excess resources that you can invest in other things like being innovative or helping other people to be innovative and so on and so forth.
Lisa, thank you so much. I find your work, whether it's watching your clips on YouTube or your reading, to be so generous in terms of explaining the expertise for people who maybe are outside the field. So I'm so grateful for you taking the time here to do a little further of that. Thank you.
Oh, it's my absolute pleasure.
Thank you to Lisa. Like I say, her new book is out right now, and How Emotions Are Made is still out. Good audiobook, that. I think that's one of the ones I did in hardback and in audio. The next two episodes are going to be very different in contrast. One is a visit to see what works like as a spy when I went to visit GCHQ. And then there's going to be a unique conversation with someone who got in touch with me, actually, and said that stress at work and the impact of work was such, it drove him right to the edge. And he found himself ready to consider suicide. I think, you know, we often think about mental health and the impact on work, but it's just such a powerful discussion. I'm so grateful for anyone who listens. Thank you for listening. Thank you for all the feedback you give. I've been Bruce Daisley. See you next time.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.